I'm Stuart Agnew. Yeah, I farm in Norfolk. I still don't really think of myself as a politician. I still think of myself as a farmer who goes to Brussels. I come across professional politicians and I realise how different I am from them. But actually, that can help. So we're just going to talk a little bit about voters. You used to, as voters, if you were my age, you held a lot of power. You held the power to run this country. And you exercised it through your vote by voting for a political party to run the country on your behalf via the manifesto they put in front of you. You lent your power to them, you didn't give it to them. That's a key word, lent. The power resided with you. You lent it to a political party for 4 or 5 years. They borrowed it from you, and they, on the strength of their manifesto, which is effectively four things, raising taxes, spending the money, making laws, scrapping old laws. That is what a manifesto is, those four things. You either approved or you didn't, gave them a chance to run the country. If you thought they'd done a reasonable job, you gave them another go, handed the power back to you, maybe borrowed again for 4 or 5 years. Yes, all right, we're the best of the bad bunch, or no, you can go. You could dismiss those who governed you, very, very key point. You could dismiss those who governed you, and the next lot who came in could undo all the laws the previous lot had made. So you exercise that power. If you had really noticed it, after each general election, when the next one came around, when the time came to hand the power back to you, if you looked closely, there was less than you'd lent, and each time it was a bit less. So where had that gone? The power of you as a voter to run this country. It had gone somewhere called the European Union via these treaties. I'm going to whiz through them, six of them. Okay. This one, Treaty of Rome, all right, was the common market, became the EEC. We knew we were going to get this. What's the CAP? What is it?
Common.
Absolutely. We knew all about that. And to be fair, farmers in this country benefited greatly for the next 10 or 15 years. It was a one-way ticket to wealth. Things changed later, and now it's quite different. What we did not know was this. You see, they realised over the water how keen Ted Heath was to sign this treaty. So they thought they'd push their luck. They said, Ted, we've been thinking. We've decided that we're going to have fishing waters as a common resource. You're going to have to throw your fishing waters in. Well, our fishing waters were far more productive, far more expansive than anybody else at the time. He said, no, I'll never get that past the British people. They said, don't worry, Ted, it won't be obvious. It'll be in the small print, and we won't do anything about it for several years. So he signed up on that basis, and they were as good as their word. And about 5, 6, 7 years later, we started noticing problems with the fishing industry. It's now vanished from our east coast and pretty well everywhere else because we've handed away the power to run it to somebody else. Crucially, these two words, he signed up to that. Very important, particularly in today's context. You're talking about the future. These two words actually govern the future. Acqui communautaire, acquisition of power to the community, or the ratchet effect. It means, in plain English, you can never take back power you have given to this organisation whilst you are a member of it. You have to leave it to get the power back. All the countries have signed up to this, so when David Cameron says, I'm going to go and negotiate powers back from the European Union, he's talking nonsense. He's breaking a treaty clause. It can't be done. All you can do is have a major treaty revision or a new treaty when everybody agrees that they're going to wind back the power of the European Union. He cannot do it on his own. He is conning anyone who says that he can, and nobody has yet managed it. Mrs. Thatcher came in. Now, she will have given the impression, and many people see her as a great Eurosceptic, she'd walk into Brussels swinging the old handbag saying, no, no, no. But in reality, under her term here, all very different, because she was signed the Single European Act. Now, to be fair to her, she didn't do the negotiation. That was left to her Foreign Secretary, Geoffrey Howe. She had three distractions during her time, three principal distractions. What were they? Does anybody know? The miners' strike, poll tax, and Falklands War. She was busy with them. Geoffrey Howe did the negotiation. She started to get worried about these things. The EU was going to be in charge of employment law. It was going to be in charge of all environmental law. Going to have an input into foreign policy. Crucially, it was going to actually be able to make laws. That parliament there, which I'm a member of, before she signed this treaty, was merely a talking shop. She signed a treaty to say that can now make laws. This is quite different to a trading arrangement, quite different. And there was more about regions. She started to get worried, so she called Nigel Lawson, the Chancellor, and Geoffrey Howell, the Foreign Secretary, to check us one Saturday morning. So she was sitting there, sir, like you are now, and I'm fat old Geoffrey Howell leaning on this side of the fireplace, and Nigel Lawson signing on that, and we say to you, Margaret, if you don't sign this treaty, we are both going to resign. Under that pressure, she signed it. She went to a town in Belgium called Bruges a few weeks later, where she gave a speech. A speech. In that speech, she said she bitterly regretted signing this, and no way was she going to sign the up-and-coming Maastricht Treaty. Once the Conservatives heard her say that, the knives were in her back just like that, she was kicked out. That was the end of Margaret Thatcher. Nothing to do with the poll tax and everything to do with her reluctance not to let the European project go forward the way it wanted to. So what happened then? John Major came in. Now, he did sign this Maastricht Treaty. This was the big one. This was the one that caused the beginnings of a party called the UK Independence Party, of which I'm obviously a member. It started because of this treaty. What was this? Citizenship imposed. Up until the time that John Major signed that treaty, we, in this country, were subjects of Her Majesty the Queen. The moment the ink dried on that, we were now citizens of the European Union, a very big change. Who are you loyal to? Who do you fight for in a war? Who's the army answerable to? Very big questions when you start talking about citizenship. But old Johnny, he just signed the thing to hell with that, it didn't really worry him. Except, of course, he had a bit of trouble with some backbenchers who we call bastards who didn't want to put the thing through. So they turned the whole thing into a vote of confidence in the government, which put some of those people in a very difficult position. And that's the only way they got it through. And the Conservative Party has never been the same again. We gave them the power to interfere in transport. HS2 is an EU concept. We probably wouldn't have dreamed it up on our own. It's an EU concept. They said to him, John, look, railways. You've got tracks and signals, and you've got rolling stock and engines. We think you ought to account for the two separately. He said, all right, if that's the rule. Well, I may as well go the whole hog and actually split them completely and have two totally separate agencies or businesses, whatever you like to call it. He then had three very serious train crashes. Everybody blamed everybody else, of course. Nobody blamed the EU. Other countries in the EU saw what had happened here, and they just left it as a paper exercise. Too late for those who died, of course. Then we got this. I've just told you, Margaret Thatcher, she said there could be such a thing as an EU law. Major signed up to the fact that those laws would be superior to our own. Again, a big step. Somebody found out about that the hard way. A vegetable trader, fruit and vegetable trader, market stall up in the north of England. Buying and selling vegetables on the market on the weekday, whichever one it was. Lady comes up to him, Steve, can I have a pound of bananas? He knew her. Yes, of course, Mary, here you are. He gives her the ways of bananas, gives her the bananas, she gives him the money. Next thing, two policemen, two trading standards officers on his stall. We're going to take your scales, sir. Why? What's wrong with them? They've got the proper weights and measures stamp. They may have. Where is the metric measurement on those scales? He is dumbfounded. He said, but nobody wants to buy metric measurements. Doesn't matter. We're taking the scales. So, of course, they take the scales. Everyone thinks he's a crook for selling short weight. That's what they assume this is all about. He has to go home with his tail between his legs. He's not on a salary. He only gets money out of what he sells. He's in trouble. He goes to a solicitor, and the solicitor says, we got good news, actually. Good news, Steve. Because 1985 Weights and Measures Act says you can't sell in either. It's there it is, black and white. Let's go for some compensation. Let's have a go at these people. Well, they go to court, Steve loses. They appeal, Steve loses. They appeal again, Steve loses. Right up to the very top, Lord Justice. Lord said, Steve, I'm very sorry to tell you, you are a criminal because we did not opt out of allowing this EU law to override our own when we had the opportunity. The shock of all of that was too much for him. He was 39. He died of a heart attack pretty well immediately, leaving two children about 10 years old and a widow. I hope every time his name is mentioned in front of the people who harass that man for no good reason, really cringe with shame. It has been turned back. It has been reversed, but not because of him. Because the people in the United States want things sold to them, exported to them in metric measurements. So there we are, poor old Steve Thorburn. Committee of the Regions, I'm not going to talk about regions today, but we're going to talk about the future, I might. Capping of expenditure with your vote, if a political party had stood in front of you and said, look, we want more of your money as tax to build new schools, hospitals, prisons, sea defences, and you said yes, they could build those things. From now on, the EU put a cap on it. Little shady little protocol from the treaty, 3% of GDP. You can't spend more on that, on these capital structures. Well, we wanted to. You might have wanted to as voters. Had to get around it somehow. There was no limit on how much of your money could be spent on rent for these things. So the private sector would build a hospital, they'd write it off over 30 years. You, the taxpayer, would rent it from that private enterprise. At the end of 30 years, they still had a very good asset. And it amazes me, you see, that was called PFI, Private Finance Initiative, where your taxes paid a rent to the private sector for the hospital. And often people hate the PFI. They think it's horrible. They think it's all wrong. And yet there are often people who think the European Union is wonderful. And they look very sad when I point this out to them. Now, another big one. Major signed this treaty. If he hadn't signed it, there would not have been a euro. They all had to sign the fact that there could be a common currency. Okay, so we got the common currency. We never joined it. But that didn't isolate us from the problems that it caused. So in it came, I'm going to skip a couple of slides and just go to this one. We are not immune from the problems in the Eurozone. Greece, because imagine children, boys, playing rugby on a Sunday morning, club rugby, at that level. The next Saturday afternoon, they go to Twickenham to play an international. They are out of their depth. And many of the countries that went into this euro were out of their depth. It was a political construct. The whole idea was to try and get as many people in as quickly as possible, get the momentum going so it couldn't falter. It had to be recognised as a serious player, which initially it was. And lenders to the eurozone thought they were lending to a common currency. And so the interest rates initially were all the same. Greece just went berserk. They had never been able to get money as cheap as that. Bought off all the public sector unions on this borrowed money, borrow on these cheap interest rates. The lenders started to then, some of these countries in the Eurozone are at worse risk than others. They started to discriminate on interest rates. Greece's interest rates started going up. Come autumn 2009, they were in real trouble. New government came in, opened the books, and Greece was utterly in debt, bankrupt, finished. They should have bailed out of the euro at that stage. At that stage, they didn't, because the political will to keep this thing going is so strong. Remember the ratchet effect, the Acquis Communautaire? This project must never go backwards. It must never undo. They had to keep it going. They bailed Greece out. And there was enough in the kitty to do that. They did have a contingency fund. Greece got bailed out. Portugal got into trouble not long after. No money left in the kitty. So we took about 4 billion quid out of your pocket as taxpayers and gave it to Portugal. We will not see that money again. Can we afford it? Ireland. We lent them 8 billion euros. We think they'll pay it back. We had to borrow it to give it back, to get it to them. We didn't actually have it. We've had to borrow it. Greece. Greece part two. Bad news. Bad news. No money in the kitty. Greece in free fall. We took another 11 billion quid out of your pocket and gave it to them. Not that it made any difference. We thought in UKIP then they would have to leave the euro. They couldn't carry on like that. We underestimated the political will to keep this going. So Greece has now surrendered its sovereignty to run itself as a country. It's now run by something called a Troika, a combination of the Commission, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank. They decide on taxes in Greece. They decide on the way the money is spent in Greece. Greece is little more than a colony now. It is suffering negative growth, which means that the GDP drops each year, fewer people are in employment each year, more people are in unemployment each year. It's a downward spiral. It's fueling the rise of far right-wing parties, thoroughly unpleasant, the Golden Dawn and others. You're seeing Nazi slogans slashed all over buildings as people think it's Germany's holding them down like this, which in a way Germany is. Paradoxically, in Germany there is now a party started called the AfD or the ADF, something like that, who don't like the fact they have to bail out these countries and keep them going. So that's an interesting situation. Will they get seats in May? I think they may well do. Spain and Italy, well, problems are expected. Because they shouldn't be in the euro, simple as that. And so the privilege of being in this currency is a very expensive one. You lose your sovereignty, your ability to govern yourself. Well, while all this was going on, these three treaties were being signed, you've witnessed me making a great fuss about it. You'd think, well, what must have been other people like Agnew around there in those days. Why weren't they making a fuss? There were two dynamics going on here. One was the three main political parties all agreed it was a wonderful thing to be doing. So there was never really any debate at any political hustings. All the candidates said, oh yeah, we should be doing this. So anyone who disagreed with all three of them was considered a bit of a nutcase. And the other dynamic was the very patronising way the whole thing was discussed in the media. Look, you go and enjoy the mortgage on your three-bedroom semi-detached house with the cars on HP in the driveway and a nice big colour television screen in the front room and go and watch football on Saturdays. You enjoy all that and we'll deal with this. We're even talking about twinning towns and playing a bit of sport. It's nothing to worry your pretty little heads about. That was the sentiment at the time. 1997, what happened? A massive landslide to Labour, a huge landslide. Tony Blair effectively could do what he want. I mean, all credit to the man, he got a huge landslide then. He then repeated that virtually vote for vote 4 years later, and still the big majority 4 years after that. The British people liked new Labour, no two ways around it. So with that mandate, he went off to Amsterdam in 1999. He signed another treaty. Now, I forgot to tell you, in the Single European Act, Mrs. Thatcher gave away the principle of a veto. The principle and the ability of Britain to be able to say no as one country and stop the whole process dead if it wanted to. She gave away the principle, replaced it with something called QMV, or qualified majority voting, which means if, in the Council of Ministers, we do not like something, we have to find a blocking minority to help us stop it. Quite crucial, actually. And as the European Union gets bigger, we're trying to talk about the future, the countries that are coming in are all the poor Eastern countries. There is now a majority of the Eurozone can block things if they want to. It's making life difficult for us. It's actually showing we haven't got a future. Anyway, he says, well, I'm going to give up our veto in a number of areas. And one of those is local aid. Quite interesting here, in Britain we have these rural post offices. They do not make money. They're there as a service to the rural community. Those who live in the rural areas go to the post office. The postmaster or the postmistress will assist them with helping forms. She is the place of authority. They like that. She runs a little shop there with it. But it loses money. It needs to be subsidised with your money, your taxpayers' money. The EU take a very different attitude to it. They say this is all part of a business. Anyone in Europe should be able to compete to do that business. You should not be subsidising it. You must cut your subsidy. So 63 rural post offices in Norfolk, which is my county, closed because our government was told to cut the subsidy. There is still some subsidy. We're still there at the behest of the EU. If they tell us to cut it even more, it'll go down. So they are desperately trying to get the remaining post offices to do enough business so they don't need a subsidy. But we are being forced down that route, whether we like it or whether we don't. Europol, that came in. The idea of a federal prosecutor, the idea of a thought crime. We used to have in this country a law about incitement of racial hatred. That was a criminal offence. And we had a law about racial discrimination in employing people, that sort of thing. Now, I can say the following. I don't like green-eyed people. That's an opinion. I don't like left-handed people. That's an opinion. I don't like red-haired people. That's an opinion. I don't like black-skinned people. That's a crime. All right? That's the difference. For the very first time in the history of this country, or for many hundreds of years, and I think with the Catholic and the Protestant thing, that was a blasphemy, but for several hundred years, you could say what you wanted to. You could state an opinion in this country, and no one could come after you. From now on, you can't. So we had the extraordinary situation at a council meeting in this country a few years ago when they were talking about a planning issue, I think. And maybe it was Tesco, I don't know, who wanted that thing. And one of the people who didn't want Tesco there said, I think I can see a chink in their armour. Somebody then stood up and said, that is a racist statement. Chink, all right? He meant aperture that lets the light through, a gap in the armour. She saw it as chink, slang for Chinese. He was hauled up in front of the authorities and sent on a racial awareness course and given an official reprimand. That is the way this can go. You're looking over your shoulder the whole time. Right, tax. Up until now, they'd left the money alone, apart from the euro. From now on, the EU started its bid to harmonise all the taxation systems in the country. Now, actually, it started at the very beginning, because you cannot join the European Union unless you have VAT up and running beforehand. You have to have that tax going and seem to be working. It is an EU tax. They then added to that, they said, so right, the EU decide on what the tax is applied to, the VAT, and the minimum rate. They don't do it all at once. They say, if you're the wrong side of that, every time you change, you must move to what we want. They then apply the same thing to fuel duty. You'll run cars, you'll know you buy fuel, it's quite expensive. The raw, the refined material isn't really very expensive. What makes it expensive is the duty that's put on top of it, and then the VAT that's levied on top of that. So, if you raise the level of duty, you then raise the amount of VAT that's payable on it. If you, as the EU, receive 1/3 or 1% of all the VAT raised in this country, it's a useful bit of income. So get the fuel duty up, get the VAT rate up, and that 1/3 of 1% is a useful bit of money. Ever since we've signed that treaty, no Prime Minister has stood in front of the electorate of this country and said, I will slash fuel duty. He cannot do it. We keep it just above their minimum in case they push it up. That is the extent to which you have lost your power. Is that good for the future? I don't know. It's up to you. You're a lot younger than me. I'm just pointing out where the power lies. He went to Nice. Nice sunny place. He signed, gave away another 39 vetoes, including the commission appointments, and on industrial policy and more on immigration and refugees. Now, this one. We never signed this one. That's the one that is the Schengen thing, where you know if you pass from Belgium to France, you aren't asked to have a passport. Same with Finland and Sweden. We never signed that, so when you come to this country from the EU, you show your passport. That's why I'm not going to dwell on that. We didn't sign it. It was bypassed. Right. They were not really confident now. 5 treaties have been signed. There was only one bit of trouble. That was in Ireland with an East treaty. They felt it was a constitutional issue. It was getting a little bit too close to their constitution. They said, we want a referendum. We're going to have a referendum. So they had a referendum and they voted against the Nice Treaty. The EU didn't like that. Wrong answer. Solution? Chuck money at Ireland. Big time. Farmers who wanted to buy a new tractor found they could buy a house with the money they received. Money just poured into Ireland. Bridges were built with the nice sign of the blue background and the yellow stars. Have another referendum and they all voted yes this time. And that wasn't the first time that's happened in Ireland either. Anyway, that's how they dealt with Ireland. Easy enough. They were confident, 5 treaties, let's bring them together and say we now have a constitution to run the European Union. And so they wrote the constitution. At the time, people thought it was a massive step forward. Actually, it wasn't. They were no extra power. But people looked at the treaties brought them together and then realised how much power we had given away. Up until that time, it hadn't really been listed and totaled. With this constitution, it was. And people started to get a bit worried about it. They got a bit, made a bit of a mistake over this because they used that word. That word meant, if it was put in front of most of the countries in Europe, it meant a referendum in those countries. By God, the people who are going to be affected by it were going to be consulted. The EU do not like that. They hate referendums. So they had to have some referendums. And Spain said yes, and I think another country did. But France said no. A founder member said no. That should have stopped the whole thing in its tracks. The veto is exercised at that point in the new treaty. The veto was always there. But they couldn't believe it. In denial, they kept the whole process going another few weeks, and then Holland had a referendum, and they said no in an even louder voice. No pretense. They couldn't keep the thing going, so it stopped. They went into a sulk for 3 years, and they came up with this idea. Let's rewrite the whole thing in complicated legalese. We'll give it the name of a nice town in Europe and call it a treaty. Excellent. If you were a lawyer and you were clever enough to unravel all that text, it would have read word for word like the Constitution. The man who wrote the Constitution, Gustave d'Estaing, he said it was the same. Your Liberal Democrat MEP in this part of the world, Andrew Duff, my colleague, he says it's the same thing. He's the opposite to me in his political philosophy, although personally we get on quite well, actually. Because we know where we stand, you see. We're honest about it. He's honest about the project. I'm honest about getting out of it. Labour and Conservative don't know what the hell they're doing. So I find them awkward to deal with. I find him, I know exactly where I am with him. Okay, it was a self-amending treaty in certain areas, actually give itself more power. And it went a step further, in any case, than the Constitution, because it brought in 2 new positions. Somebody called the permanent president of the European Union, a man called Van Rompuy, was just dragged out of obscurity and told, you will be the best paid politician in the world, you are now permanent president of the European Union. giving him that tag, sort of puffed out his chest, so he wandered into Italy a year or two ago, pointed to a civil servant and said, "You're going to be the next Prime Minister of Italy, because I say so." And that's what happened. A lot of power to Van Rompuy, isn't there? Marvellous. And of course, they then had said, one of the commissioners will be a high representative, will effectively trump all the foreign ministers in all the European countries, and they happened to choose the British one, who happened to be Baroness Ashton, so she now has a very sweet office in Strasbourg, where we go once a month, we're going there next week. I've got a grim little office. Three floors above me, she has got a very suite of offices up there. Oh, they've puffed up her importance. She is the best paid female politician in the world. Nobody elected to the position she's got. And effectively, William Hague has to crawl to her. Really, he's no longer going to run the foreign policy of this country. You may think that's great. It worries me. Right, what have we ended up with now after all of this? There are two systems in which you are governed, okay? This one, it does still exist. 25% of the laws that govern you are initiated in Westminster. As I talked about, the power of the voters, you choose your government on the basis of their manifesto. They make the laws. That goes through the Commons. There are escape hatches, pressure relief valves here in the form of early day motions or private member's bill, where things are discussed that the government might not want to be discussed, but because they've got a majority, it goes through. It then goes to the Lords. They have a revising role. They shouldn't throw this out on the sentiment of it. They should throw it out if they think it's going to be ambiguous, contradicts another law, is going to be difficult to enforce. That's why they throw it out. They can throw it out three times. After that, the Commons can do what? They can enact the Parliament Act, absolutely, which is what they did on the Fox Hunting Bill, because the Lord said, look, how can you enforce a law that says, well, you can chase a mammal with a dog, but you mustn't enjoy the spectacle? How are you going to enforce a thing like that? The Lords could see it. They didn't throw it out because there were a lot of tops in red coats. They could see it couldn't be enforced, and they were quite right. There is more hunting done now than there was then. Everybody goes, but actually everybody's happy because the antis feel the law's been passed and the people who did hunt still go hunting. And as long as they've got an eagle or a bird of prey with them, they can chase as many foxes as they want. So then the civil service draft the law, and you, with your vote, can undo the entire thing if you want to. You can scrap everything that was done. It's entirely in your hands. Very different over the water here. What have we got here? A number of institutions. Quite complicated. I won't put in all the arrows. Let's start with this one. First of all, there's confusion. The European Council. Anybody know what it is? What is it?
It's where all the of member states sit.
It's where the heads of government go and meet. Okay, Cameron would go there.
Right.
Hollande would go there. Merkel would go there. But they sit between three and six times a year. But European Council mustn't be confused with Council of Europe. You'd have thought, well, it's two ways of saying the same thing. No, it isn't. One is an EU institution, the other one is not an EU institution. But there is room for confusion. And even some political journalists get mixed up, particularly with something else later on.
Even David Cameron recently.
Sorry?
Even David Cameron recently.
Well, yeah. He thinks he can get power back from the EU without having a new treaty. He doesn't know anything about it. Right. European Commission. This is the powerhouse of the whole thing. What's it made up of? 28 commissioners, one from each country. But when they go there, they say immediately, we will always put that ahead of that. They don't go there to represent their country. They go there to be given a portfolio. Okay, so one of them is given agriculture. Across the whole of the European Union, all 28 states, he's the only person out of 550 million who can initiate proposed legislation on agricultural matters. Another one on transport. Another one on the environment. Another one on consumer issues. And so it goes on. That is their portfolio, and their portfolio is what counts, not the country they came from. If, when they retire as a commissioner, they start to speak against the European Union, their pension is at risk. So in the House of Lords, you've got Maddelson and Kinnockin people, they should declare an interest whenever an EU subject is discussed, that they don't. But they should, because it is very much in their interest to have this thing carrying on. They get a very good pension. If they were to speak against it, they would lose the pension. Quite a good way of keeping control, really, isn't it? So the Commission. have these. Let's talk about agriculture. I'm on the Agriculture Committee, 44 MPs, 22 regularly turn up. I am one of those. 8 of those 22 actually know something about farming, and I am one of those. Unfortunately, I come from UKIP, so I'd rather rock the boat and spoil the show. I have quite a lot of fun, actually. But at least I can talk sense about farming in that committee. So, the Commissioner wants to throw in a proposal, wants to get something through. Imagine a joint of meat at the butcher's. Okay, you have a bone with meat around it. That's tossed in. The MEP said, woof! On they go onto that meat, reorganising it, tearing some of it off. They may get rid of all of it. But the bone is always there. And even if the MEPs get rid of all that flesh and tell everyone how clever they are and how hard they work, that bone goes through. The flesh that's left is cleared up off the floor, and that makes another joint. Some of that becomes a bone, and that goes through a few years later. The three R's, ruthlessness, remorselessness, and relentlessness, that is how the EU keep going. That is the future of the EU. Those three words, they keep going at all costs. Okay, so we have a bit of fun in committee, all these amendments we put to it, and they're voted on in committee. Then it goes to plenary session, where if it's gone through committee, it's pretty well given it'll go through on the first reading. If it goes through on the first reading, they don't even bother to vote on it in the next two readings. While all that's happening, these people are informed, but it's pouring out of there at such a rate, we haven't got enough people here to cope with it. If we haven't reacted within 6 months, something called an override clicks in. They say, well, UK, you've had your chance to think about this. We're going ahead without you now. So it goes to plenary, goes through that. Then it goes to this, the Council of Ministers. If it's an agriculture, it is all 28 Ministers of Agriculture will meet, and this is where the vetoes come in. If Paterson didn't like that CAP reform, which he didn't, and under the old rules, he could veto it. Remember, we are net contributors to this thing. We put every year £7.2 billion into that CAP. Our farmers get about £3.6 back again. It's a big deal. It's a lot of British money going in there. Paterson cannot veto. All he can do is try and get some other countries around him as a blocking minority. So that's how that's exercised. So it goes through, particularly with the Eurozone now voting as a bloc, and particularly, of course, with the poorer countries. They don't want to rock the boat. They're net recipients. They want to keep the whole thing going. So, again, we're talking about the future. Is there a future for a net contributor in the European Union that isn't in the Eurozone? And I would have said, no, there isn't. Now, this Council of Ministers, they got this crowd behind them, CAREPA. What are they? It's called the Committee of the Permanent Representatives. What it is, a British civil servant based over there, advising. So the minister walks in to the debate, and the civil servant, the ACREP chapter, says, here you are, minister, and this is how you're going to vote. I decide how to vote. I'm the minister. Yes, minister. That's rather how it's done. They make all the decisions beforehand. The minister goes in there, drowning with paper and detail. Now, just vote it through, won't you? Be a good chap. And so it goes through. Right. These things come out of here as in different ways. Decisions. That's actually a technical thing. If they discover that two EU laws are fighting one another, they have to decide which has precedence and a decision is made. Regulations. These don't normally go through the parliamentary process. The Commission have the power to make these regulations and then law in member state without any changing in the wording virtually the next day. It is to try and standardise the brightness of street lamps, that sort of thing. Of course, the Commission would like to abuse it. And sometimes they get away with it. But mainly, though, it's these things, directives. A directive then comes back here, and the member state is treaty-bound to put it into law. Treaty-bound to do it. They have to do it. So you will hear, and we did hear, Conservatives say the last election, of course, Labour brought in this law. Rubbish. Labour transposed an EU directive, and they had no option but to do that, and the Conservatives would have had to have done exactly the same thing. Finally, this lot here. Again, a bit of a confusion. EU Court of Justice, nothing to do with the European Court of Human Rights, nothing at all. What is it there to do? It's nothing to do with justice, nothing to do with justice. It is there to watch what you are doing. Your representatives have been voted in here. Are they making laws that might cause the EU, this country, to divorce or disengage or detach? If they think that law is likely to have that consequence, they will scrap it. They have that power, skull and crossbones. That is why the manifestos are so thin now. That is why the political parties will steer away from anything that might bring this lot in, and they are third-rate judges, some of these people. They wouldn't be fit to be judges in this country. However, we are in their hands when it comes to that. Right. How do we sit? We sit in the hemicycle instead of one opposite the other, and we are encouraged to form groups, because what they do not want is all the British to sit here, and all the French to sit there, and all the like that. They had to get us to forget nationalities. Remember, the project is about a new country, old countries will fade away. Andrew Duff never talks about Britain, he talks about the place where I come from. They've got to get rid of the nation, get rid of the nation state. There will be three layers, three tiers. The EU, the regions, and the unitary authorities. That is the future. You ask me about the future, that is the future. The member states are being squeezed all the time, and the Eurozone accelerates that process. So we have to form a group, or they encourage us to form a group because they do not want us to sit in national blocks, so they sit in your political colours, and you form a group, thresholds. You need seven countries, minimum of seven countries to form a group, and a minimum of 30 MEPs from those countries. You can have one each from six and the balance from the other one, but there must be 30/7. That is the rule. Having got that, it's quite good to be in a group. Three big advantages. They incentivise you to form a group. We get a bigger information budget per MEP. I stress, this is not money we can take out of our back pocket and fiddle, but it's money I can apply to the European Union if I want to publish a pamphlet or have an advertisement. I show them what I want to do. They look at it, they approve it, or they disapprove it, or they say no. They then want to see the finished item, and the transaction is paid. I never see the money. They pay the supplier direct. As an MEP in a group, I get a much bigger budget for that. So that's an incentive. Another incentive is that the leader of the group, he gets guaranteed speaking time at major debates, and he sits at the corner, front of the slice of cake. It's that privilege that Nigel Farage has, is where he always is able to deliver these speeches that go onto YouTube. He couldn't have done that if he wasn't the leader of a group. That's been the big advantage to him, and we realise the value of it. When some of them have 8 million hits, you know you're getting somewhere. Like it or love it or hate him, he has become the best well-known politician in Europe, really. So they sit there at the front. And the other incentive is we get a very good staff budget, and we get excellent members of staff. I mean, I'm not an academic individual. I'm a chicken farmer. I spend all my life farming, except perhaps some time spent in Rhodesia. But the people we get to help us, these are double firsts from this establishment. These are bright people, and I'm really grateful for their assistance and help with the parliamentary process. And it's a good combination, myself and Tony Brown, who's this Cambridge graduate. He understands that in fine detail. I put in the basic agricultural knowledge, and between us, we've now become quite a formidable team in there. Inasmuch as there's ever a break in the committee, people often drift up to us wanting to discuss things. I rather like it, actually. It makes me feel important. Now, what are all these union jacks? What are they? They're British bums, okay, to put it rather crudely. British seats, British MEPs. That's where how we sit. Now, let's look at some of these groups. This one, the Communist Green Group. Communism is alive and well in the European Union. Many of those old Soviet bloc states still have got some good old diehard communists. Up until recently, the leader of this group was a man called Lothar Bisky. Well, Lothar in his younger days was boss of the Stasi, East German secret police. And I'm a fairly big, strong individual. But I found myself in a lift with him one day, and I did not like it. Those eyes of his, my God, I would not want to have been interrogated by that man. Anyway, he's a leader of the communist group. There he isn't now. And actually, to be fair, he had an illness, and now he's died. But that was really all quite sudden and quite recent. Maybe there is some justice, because I wonder what he knows, that man. Okay, so you've got the Communist Greens there. Now, some of you might say, what the hell is that doing there? A British MEP sitting with the communists? Who could that be?
Green.
Sinn Féin, Northern Ireland. He sits, she was a she, I think another she now. Anyway, that they choose to sit there. Then you've got the Socialist Bloc, of course, all the Labour MEPs sit there, the 13 of them. Then you've got the ordinary Greens. So you've got two lots of Greens, the communist Greens and the ordinary Greens. Some of you might say, hello, Mr. Aggie, you've got that wrong. There should only be two Union Jacks in there. There's only two Green MEPs. However, the Welsh Nationalists and Scot Nationalists have chosen to sit with the Greens. So there you go there. Our Liberal Dems, Dandridge Duff and Co, they sit there. Now, the Tories did sit here. This, in Europe, is called the right of centre group. We would actually say its philosophy was marginally left of centre. The Tories were most uncomfortable sitting in that group. It was a federalist group. So at the end of the last parliament, they pulled out and they formed, helped form this group here, which is called the European Conservative Reform Group, where they think they can reform the European Union. And if anyone wants to ask me a question, I'll tell you how far they haven't got with that. I never thought that Farage would be able to form a group when he was competing for similar people with them. I just thought he couldn't do it. To his great credit, he did do it. We are the smallest group. We've just about hung together. Some pretty strange characters in it, but we got what we wanted. Some people can't. You've got these saddos around the back here. Nobody wants them in their group, or they don't want to be in a group. That would be the British National Party, the Front National from France, that type of person. It is assumed after May the 25th that there'll be enough of those far-right people to actually create their own group around here, and we will shove around there somewhere. It's expected that we may, if Farage is ambitious enough, might even be the third biggest group. I just feel that the bigger the group, the more unmanageable it is, and we really don't want to go too far down that route, but that's above my pay grade. But that, talking about the future, I think you'll see a big shrinkage here, particularly there. The Greens are not popular now. Their energy policies, which are being put through. See, they swing a lot of weight. This group and that group don't want to lose votes to the Greens. So you can be a bit green, you can't be a bit UKIP, but you can be a bit green. And so between that lot, they're nearly half the parliament. You only need a few individuals here and some of the saddos here, and they've got the green legislation through, which is so damaging to our businesses and industry here. It keeps going through. That's become very unpopular in some countries now. I'm sure they're going to lose seats. So we're going to see a different looking parliament. The commissioner, if we're talking about agriculture, Jason Chillis, the commissioner, he'll be here, full of his civil servants. Council. Every 6 months, a country takes it in turn to chair the council meetings. There's a bit of a problem with Van Rompuy, because he's the permanent president. What does the prime minister of the country do that's supposed to be doing it? Well, it seems they take it in turns. I haven't quite got to the bottom of it. Anyway, at the moment it's Greece. They are chairing the thing. That's a little bit silly, because the country that has the presidency is supposed to steer and drive the European Union for the next 6 months to say we're going to have these landmarks. And here is Greece, basically a basket case in a position like that. So the joke is they brought the elections forward early to reduce the length of the Greek presidency, because they're much earlier than they normally are. Right. Now, I've been talking about how deeply this thing is getting into our lives. There's another dimension going on here. When it started, it was this size. When we joined it, that's what it was. And you might have said, well, such a political project was just about possible with these countries. Just close enough in culture, language, finance, etc., to form maybe a bloc, a significant political bloc. All right, the mafia down here at the bottom end of Italy, a bit of a problem. But you could say, might have done it, you might have done it. However, it's got bigger. And it's got bigger, 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 and it's yet to get even bigger. Now, there are two dynamics that come in here that nobody can deny. The first is we are losing influence. We cannot be gaining influence and being at the heart of Europe and driving it when we are constantly having fewer people in the Council of Ministers, less influence there, fewer MEPs. You see, when they keep bringing in these countries, there isn't room in the Parliament for the level of representation that used to be. So there used to be 90-odd MEPs in Britain, now it's down to 72. We used to have 8 here when they first went to a regional system. That's went down to 7. There's only so much room in the Parliament. The other thing, of course, is the difference in culture now. We've got 3 cultures, really, in the European Union. Attitudes to law and authority. You've got the old boring ones like us. You know, we take the law seriously. Directive comes from Brussels and we will transpose it and properly gold plate it and make sure it's a really good law. Here, you've got the Manana Brigade. Well, yes, we'll get through to transposing it and we send people to Brussels and they make laws, but they need to take it seriously. We'll get around to it when we feel like it. No, take it easy, old chap. You know, don't be so silly and stay like these miserable people up here. Make life a little bit of fun, you know, it's not that important. But then you've got the third culture, where through the Soviet influence, corruption is simply embedded in the civil service, where if you want to say you complied with the law, you have to pay somebody, bribe somebody, and the box is ticked. Now, some of you will laugh about this, and I notice the odd patronising grin around the room. I'll tell you that a journalist approached three Eastern European MEPs and said, if you table this amendment, he pretended to be somebody else, can you table this amendment? And if you do, I'll give you €5,000. And all three said yes, they'd do it. That's the level of it. And it's not just there, of course. These countries send their fair share of people into the commissioners, the bureaucrats. That is your future, because this thing is only going to get bigger that way. They can't go into the sea. And you've got these problems further across here. That is the way these people live. If you get into a position of authority, you use that to make money for yourself. That is how it works there. If you don't believe me, I'll give you a story about my son, who was at Gresham School, a private school up in North Norfolk. He was great friends with a Bulgarian boy. They were both going to take the driving test in the Easter holidays about 4 or 5 years ago now. My son went to King's Lynn, where he got out of a muddle on the big Hardwick roundabout there. Other drivers started shaking their fists at him and hooting their horns at him. Then he hit the curb when he did a three-point turn. And then the examiner said, oh, Mr. Agnew, take the next turn left. And took the next turn left. Two new entry signs went straight through them. So he failed. He deserved to fail. He has passed subsequently. He went back, beginning of the summer term, saw his Bulgarian friend. Garth, my boy, said, oh, I failed. But it was all the examiner. It was everybody else's fault, not Garth's, of course. How did you get on, he said, to the Bulgarian boy. And the Bulgarian boy said, when I saw how small the bribe was that my father gave to the examiner, I knew I'd fail. We drove around for about 5 minutes and came back again. That is how it works, like it or not. And it's going to take a long time to change it. And in more countries that come in like that, the more difficult it's going to get. Right, your votes still do count for something. The areas in red here are the areas that your votes control, all right? Not an awful lot now, and it's shrinking. The area in blue is where the EU has the final say, is where they drive the whole thing. So there's not a lot of red left. The Reverend Philip Foster, who doesn't live that far from here, is one of our members. He produced this for me about, I don't know, not quite 15 years ago. But then, that red was more like that. And he rang me up one day and said, Angus, I'm going to have to change it. anyway, that's what you've got. Finally, final slide, because this is interesting. If you're going to create a brand new country, which is what they're doing, you obviously need your common currency. Ultimately, you need to bring it down from 22 languages to 2 or 3. You need common taxation, you need common laws, and you need a common justice system. Now, there's a bit of a problem. Two countries of the 28 have a system based on habeas corpus. The remaining 26 have systems based loosely on corpus juris. And they're very different. Very different systems. Because when you have a justice system, you have to make a decision between the complete liberty of the individual and the total authority of the state. Somewhere between those two, you draw a line of justice. Our system of habeas corpus has that line erring more to the liberty of the individual, and corpus juris is the other way about. So what are the differences? Okay, habeas corpus. If you, the poor off the street, by me, I can't hold you for more than 24 hours, possibly 96 in exceptional circumstances, without charging you with a recognised crime. Here, I can just sling you in jail and leave you there for as long as I feel like it. This system, you can opt to be tried by a jury of your peers, was the expression, I think. Here, the verdict is by a career judiciary. Now, some people say to me, oh, that's not Mr. Agnew, no. Look at that arrow, that red arrow. Things aren't moving. Presumption of innocence, only in theory, but here we have it, because of all these other things. Double jeopardy, we have that. If you're acquitted of a crime, you cannot be reconvicted of it unless there is a lot of new evidence. Under this system, there can be repeated trials. Here, we have the right to silence, and someone will say, oh no, you don't anymore. Look at the arrow, we've lost it now. Right to silence. In those days, the state had to prove you were guilty. You did not have to help them in any way at all by saying anything that might incriminate yourself. You could keep quiet. It was up to them to prove you were guilty. Now, silence means guilt. We said that no hearsay evidence or previous form. You have to be tried on the evidence of that crime alone, not all the pickpocketing and pilfering and shoplifting you did when you were a naughty young man. Here, all that sort of thing can be brought in. We have press restrictions. We have something called sub judice. If a newspaper is covering a court case, you won't see photographs, somebody will write a sketch. Here, the press can speculate and name names. Critically, what does habeas corpus mean? It means, in Latin, you have the body, you have to be brought in present to be tried. Under the system, you can be tried in your absence and be found guilty. Okay, that's what we're going to. That describes the project. Do you like it or don't you? I'll have to answer questions and receive the eggs, tomatoes and all the rest of it. Thank you very much.